Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Mike Lewick, Associate Professor of Physical Therapy in the University of North Carolina's Department of Allied Health Sciences, about the rising science of falls. Falls are one of the universal aspects of life, from children, where we fall a lot and have to get back up, to middle ages, where we trip, fall, going down steps, going up, running, to, as we get older, getting debilitated, having strokes, having diseases like Parkinson's that maybe inhibit our mobility, rehabilitation from falls. These are things we're going to talk about today and the science of this with Dr. Lewick. I'm really looking forward. First, however, we got some research that matters. And in the very first research that matters, it's shocking, not just because of the topic, but because of how it came about. And this is a medication spelled A-D-U-C-A-N-U-M-A-B, aducanumab. That's not an easy one to say, but it's a drug that's for Alzheimer's. And there are really so few drugs that are been on the market and so few that have come about in the last decade to help with Alzheimer's. And this was a drug that Biogen had originally said it didn't work. And yet they did a reanalysis of data and they discovered that there was a trend of it actually working. It had been stopped sooner by the Data Safety Monitoring Board, but it was stopped before they had actually had looked at all of the data. And once all of the data came in, they said that the doses that were higher than what they had given early on in the studies are actually the doses that worked, and that those doses worked well enough that they believe that this could be approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And you know, anything that really could help people to have prevent the clinical decline would really be critical. And I think this particular medication is worthy of looking at. It's worthy of looking at by the Food and Drug Administration. It's worthy of looking at by those who may be using it and providers. I think we're all going to have to come to our own opinion, given the initial early warnings of it not working to a reanalysis showing that it may work in a different dosing. But it's one that I think everyone's interested in who has any family members who've had Alzheimer's or who have Alzheimer's or worried about themselves getting Alzheimer's. Our next research that matters is one, again, about a common problem, and this is high blood pressure. We're talking about, you know, 10-15% of the population, United States, around the world, really having high blood pressure. And this was research out of Spain where they had 20,000 patients that they followed for 6 years, and they randomized them to take their blood pressure in the morning or in the evening before they go to sleep. Now, if you ask me, would that going to make a huge difference? I would have said, I don't think so. But guess what? I would have been wrong. This is really important and interesting research because they looked at the risk of, you know, heart attacks and strokes, and they found that those who took their blood pressure medicine at night had a lower risk. They were 45% less likely to die of all heart disease causes, 56% less likely to die of specific types of cardiovascular diseases, 61% less likely to die of stroke, and they were less likely to have a heart attack, to need the procedures to open up the hearts, develop heart failure. I think one of the directors of University of Pittsburgh's Heart and Vascular Hypertension Center, who was not involved in doing the study, said, it's remarkable. And I would agree, it is remarkable. Would I like to see this replicated? I would, but this is one of the largest randomized controls I've seen in a long time for such a typical problem, and its robust findings. It suggests at the very least that lowering blood pressure at night, and these patients who are hypertensive may have all kinds of benefits. It maybe it lowers it, which they didn't see, but maybe it lowers it in the daytime as well. I think it's worth talking with your doctors about it, looking at this study, but it's research that I think can have an impact. Speaking of having impact, our next research that matters is actually something really quite simple, which is how do we get more physical activity? And can phone apps do this? Can our Apple watches do it? You get to track your physical activity. And for a lot of people, this becomes a way of life and it does increase their physical activity. For this particular study, though, what they wanted to see is they were using an app called My Heart Counts, which I wasn't familiar with, many people would be. And they then wanted to see if they had different ways of kind of coaching people to be able to track their steps and to use their steps. And what they did was these prompts to complete 10,000 steps to a prompt to stand after an hour of sitting. That could be physical activity, even though it's just standing. Instructions to read physical activity guidelines to the American Heart Association website, not the most active one, but maybe it would stimulate activity, or coaching based on the person's personal activity patterns. Now, they had 2,000 people volunteer for the study, but only 500 completed these interventions and participated for 35 days or longer. So this tells me one thing right off the bat. Most people don't complete these sorts of things, even in a study, even if they either volunteered or maybe were getting paid a little bit for that. But for those that were put in the different conditions, they all did a little bit. Averages rose by 300 steps for the Heart Association website prompt, 260 steps for the hourly standing group, 250 steps for the e-coaching, and 226 steps for the 10,000 a day daily step prompt. I will say, you know, I don't see a control condition, so it may have been just by participating in a study and you're the ones that stayed in the study. You know, if you had said to people, don't do any physical activity and just sit, whatever the control is that, you know, was not designed to increase activity, would they have increased? However, on the other hand, I don't see that there were side effects here. Standing up every hour when you're awake rather than being at your desk can't really probably be a bad thing all in all. So something I'm interested in, but a lot more work needs to be done to see if we can really recommend one of these things or the other. Last research that matters has to do with language barriers. And this is important. It speaks a lot to me. I have a fair number of patients who speak Russian, and I know, since I don't speak Russian, that the conversation is better when I have a Russian interpreter there than when I don't have a Russian interpreter. For my Spanish-speaking patients, my Japanese-speaking patients, my patients for Myanmar, I need to have Mandarin available. And I'm really fortunate that in the healthcare environment I work in, the healthcare system I work with, I can get interpreters when I need them. And the conversations, while they take longer, are better. I think that the outcomes could be better because people understand. And this particular research is really about, well, what happens with readmissions to the hospital when people with language barriers have the same condition? So let's say obstructive pulmonary disease from smoking. Someone who has a language barrier, doesn't speak English, compared to maybe someone who speaks English wholly with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And it turns out that their readmission rates are higher. And I'm sure this is controlling for other sorts of things like smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol, and so forth. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And it was really for complicated conditions that they found these readmission rates being higher. So heart failure, this chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, not for pneumonia or hip fractures, which may be just really easy to treat. These other ones are more complicated, lots of medications to there. And what they're finding is that some people with limited English proficiency aren't getting the same level of patient education likely, because it would take a much longer time and to be answered those questions and the complicated nature of it. I know when I round in the hospital, patients can get hundreds of handouts in English for so many conditions. It can be overwhelming, even for English speaking, in the readmission rates trying to reduce, much less for people who speak different languages for which it's more difficult to provide that service, but we must provide that service. That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Mike Lewick, Associate Professor of Physical Therapy in the University of North Carolina's Department of Allied Health Sciences, about the science of falls. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research.
To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Mike Lewick, Associate Professor of Physical Therapy in the University of North Carolina's Department of Allied Health Sciences, about the rising science of falls. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Lewick.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great.
I didn't fall on my way into the studio today. I haven't had a major fall in a while. That's good, right?
That is a great thing, yes.
I imagine falls are kind of like a universal thing. Everyone falls. Sometimes we talk about young kids that fall.
Everybody falls. I had my own fall a couple weeks ago.
Well, you look pretty good, so it wasn't too bad. And actually, I'm about to go on a bike ride for 2 weeks overseas, and I'm praying I don't fall, because falling on a bike is much worse, I think, than falling just as you're walking.
Well, you're moving a lot quicker.
Moving a lot quicker.
The faster you're moving, the harder you're going to fall.
Well, I know we're going to really get into the science of falls and your research, which is really fascinating and important. I think we'd like to know a little bit about you, first off. How did you get interested in physical therapy, faculty member, and even doing any research in falls? Because it's not every day, but it's every day important.
Yeah, it is. I've been interested in understanding mobility after stroke for a while. And that's kind of how I started down this road. You know, in some of the work that we were doing, we were training people, doing walking-related gait training. And I noticed that people were tripping as they were walking. And I realized, you know, we have all this data as we're recording that we can go back and figure out why they're tripping. So we did that. We did some studies where we looked at the data of trip steps and non-trip steps and realized that some of them are very different. And some
what do you mean by trip steps? Like you're stepping and that process is triggering a trip or?
Yeah, so as you're walking, your goal is to be able to advance your foot without having to hit the ground. And for the most part, we are very successful at doing that. It's the times when your foot hits the ground inadvertently that causes the trip. And so when you trip and the rest of your body continues to move forward, you have the potential to fall.
You know, that's interesting because I would have thought commonly, and I think I'm probably wrong, that falls are caused not by a person's trip step, but by, you know, what's in front of you that you didn't see, the barrier, the uneven terrain, that sort of thing, that those are the most common reasons. Is that not the case?
That's actually not the case. Falls can happen for a variety of reasons. They can happen because somebody puts something in front of you. You trip on a curb. You trip on a carpet. The dog gets in front of you. That's how I fell. So, yeah, there's external things that can cause you to fall. But that's not the primary reason that people are falling. A lot of times people fall because they move incorrectly. And every time you take a step, that step doesn't look exactly the same as the step before it. There's a little bit of variability from step to step. And it's that little bit of variability that leads to the trip, because every once in a while, your foot's going to hit the ground.
Interesting. And so you had some interest in kind of the mobility and the falls associated with strokes. How did you get interested in that?
Yeah. So because somebody's had a stroke, has weakness on one side of their body, or they have a diminished ability to be able to move or control one half of their body, they're more likely to trip. Because, again, more than half of the trips that occur happen because of the way that you are moving, not because somebody else did something to you. So we talk about the difference between an intrinsically generated trip, something where you're doing it yourself, versus an extrinsically generated trip, which is when the carpet gets in your way or the dog gets in your way. So most of the trips that happen are intrinsically generated. It happens because of the way that you're moving. And when you lose the ability to control your leg as well as you did before your stroke, you're more likely to trip. And so we have people who come in and they say, I can walk around just fine, but I keep getting my foot stuck. And so I say, well, you know, where are you going? Okay, so I'm going to the grocery store and I'm walking around, but then I get tired and then I start to trip, or then I get my foot hits the ground, and all it takes is that one time for me to go down, and that's what's gonna cause the injury.
So I'm thinking about patients, family members. You know, this is one of those things, unfortunately, that we have too much personal experience with. And at the different ages, let's take young kids or teens, and then maybe people in their 30s and 40s, and then people in their 60s and 70s, does that intrinsic, extrinsic change? Are the same things really happening? I mean, I think kids are just running so fast. It's hard to sometimes stop.
Yeah. Yeah, it probably does change based on your stage in life, based on the deficits that you may or may not have in your body. So yeah, certainly. Kids trip for a lot of different reasons than an adult might trip. Kids are going to fall because something got in their way, or they were going too fast, and you know, they're barreling through the house and don't see that there's, you know, a wet spot on the floor. So yeah, kids trip for a lot of different reasons.
Well, a lot of us could trip for wet spots on the floor, yeah. And I imagine, and I know that there's a lot of falls from pet associated, like you talked about. I wonder also about, I see people texting while they're walking across intersections, and I just wonder and worry about how many people fall. Normally, you would see a step, and you would, even if it's like 3 inches, right? And you lift your leg up. But if you don't see it, you fall.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's actually one of the ways that we are trying to promote trips in the lab so that we can study them. So we never cause a trip in somebody when they're in the lab. But in order to study them, we have to be able to observe a trip. And so we have people walking in the lab, and then we do things to distract them so that they trip themselves. And we try to do things that would ordinarily cause them to trip out in the real world. And although we're not having them text, we will do things that distract and take away attention. So we'll have them, you know, count backwards by sevens. We'll have them, you know, turn their head or look in different directions or close their eyes. Things that might cause you to lose your balance in the real world are highly variable. And you're distracted by a lot of things out in the world.
I'm thinking about, you know, I was traveling recently and I go to the gymnasium that they have in the hotel, and I get on the treadmill and I start running on the treadmill. But I was thinking about, gosh, it's so easy to fall on this treadmill. Mm-hmm. It's moving, I'm increasing its velocity, and I have to really concentrate about not going too fast, too slow, and falling.
Yeah.
That's intrinsic, extrinsic? What's going on there? Or is it just this really a dangerous piece of equipment?
Well, it could just be a dangerous piece of equipment. So we always have people harnessed in our lab, so we know nobody's ever going to fall. So we're studying trips. We do not want to study the fall. We want to prevent
yes.
the fall. But you're right. People do fall off treadmills all the time. And we have a lot of people who come in, and if they haven't been on a treadmill ever or since their injury, it's a very different feeling being on a treadmill. There's a disconnect between what your eyes are seeing and what your legs are doing. And so you're walking on the treadmill or you're running on the treadmill and your eyes are going, I'm not moving. And your legs are going, yeah, I am. So you're getting very conflicting information from the information from your legs versus what your eyes are telling you. And that's confusing for the body. And that's why people feel like they're moving faster on a treadmill than they really are.
So help me understand this connection between this hand, eye, leg, sensation, movement, because I've not really thought about how important all the senses potentially are towards positioning and, of course, even balance as well. And I'm sure balance has to be a part of this as well.
It is a part of that, yeah. There's sensory information that you're collecting from all parts of your body at all times. And although the human body is not a machine, it's built somewhat like a machine. You have your central nervous system, which is pulling all this information from your legs and from your arms and from your eyes and your ears, and giving you all this information that it has to process in real time and make a decision. And when some of the information may not be accurate or some of the information is not considered valid by your brain, then that's what might cause you to fall. That's what leads to deficits in balance in some cases.
Well, this is really interesting. We're going to want to come back to this. I want to understand a little bit really more how the deficits come about, because, you know, if it were just as simple, it's not simple, as getting people stronger so they don't fall when they get weak as they get older, then maybe, but it sounds like it's a lot more complicated. So we're going to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Mike Lewick, Associate Professor of Physical Theory in the UNC's Department of Allied Health Sciences, about the science of falls. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Mike Lewick, Associate Professor of Physical Therapy in the University of North Carolina's Department of Allied Health Sciences, about the science of falls. Right before the break, Mike, we were talking about the importance of the different senses. And I just want to just explore just a little bit. Help me understand the senses that are really key and critical. And when they go awry, like I think about when someone has a stroke, well, they get weak on one side. But is it just the weakness? It seems like there are other things at play.
There are other things at play. So particularly for somebody who's had a stroke, sometimes they exhibit problems with sensation in their leg. So it's almost like the leg feels numb, and they're not getting the appropriate information sent back to the spinal cord and to the brain. And so they're losing information, so to speak, and that makes it hard for control. And when we think about maintaining your balance, some of the things that are important are making sure that there's adequate strength in your muscles. Strength is important, but strength without control doesn't really tell you a whole lot. It's important to be able to control the muscles in a meaningful way. And that's what the challenge becomes after a stroke. There's weakness, certainly, but there's a loss of control. And some people never really gain that sense of control. And that's where we're trying to work towards coming up with ways that we can control the muscles for them.
So if we think about certain disease states, let's say someone who has Parkinson's, everyone is somewhat familiar, they've seen someone with Parkinson's, they've got that shuffling gait, and they don't pick their feet up. We must have ways of compensating, and you must work with people to compensate for things that you can't do. If someone has a neuropathy from diabetes, you can't really repair the sensation, so you have to try to figure out how to overcome it. So help us understand how you go about dealing with some of these irreversible things that really will predispose and push people to falls.
Yeah, that's a great question. So some of the things that we are looking at is using things like robotics, using things like electrical stimulation, which sounds kind of scary, but your muscles are controlled by electrical impulses from your nerves. Well, when those are not working appropriately, we can bypass your own body's electrical system and just activate the muscles on their own using an electrically stimulated device. So we have ways of bypassing your body's systems for improved control. And that's ultimately where we intend to go with this. We hope that we can intervene only at appropriate times so that people are not falling. And we want to be able to provide control for patients who don't have the means by which they can provide the control for themselves.
So what about even low tech? What do we have today that, you know, I mean, people think about walkers. Are all walkers the same? Does that make a difference? Is a cane better, worse than a walker? Help us understand the low tech. What do we need to know? Because I think it's critical.
Yeah, I agree. Canes, walkers, those are great devices. They provide you with an increased base of support. So they give you more room on the ground to be able to push on. And so when you have a walker, you are less likely to fall. Now, of course, you have to be able to hold on to the walker, which means you need good control of your hands. So those are some of the critical issues we think about. But yeah, low-tech devices are super, super helpful.
I see people walking with the canes, and sometimes like, I'm like, does it really help you or not, you know?
A cane can be really helpful, yeah, for maintaining stability. It depends on the person, yeah. Some people don't need a walker. And if they don't need a walker, we'd prefer them not have to carry around something that's a little bit heavier.
I remember my mom used a walker. Boy, could she go fast. It was only like you could go fast with the walker than not. And then having the bench in the walker seemed to be really what a great invention, just to have a place to rest when you're walking.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about your research. I know you've got some recent grants. You've got a center or a whole group of folks. Help us understand what you're doing in the laboratory to help translate this to people.
Yeah. So in the lab, we are having folks come in. People who've had stroke, we're having them come in. People that typically trip, maybe fall, and we're recording the trips. And when I say recording, we have a fancy motion capture system in the lab that allows us to record three-dimensional motion of people. And we take that information and then try to figure out what is contributing to the trips that looks different than all the successful non-trip steps. And if you think about your walking, you know, you watch your Fitbit or your Apple Watch, and they're encouraging you to take 10,000 steps a day, right? Well, if I told you that you were going to trip only once out of 10,000 times, you're like, well, I like those odds. It's not bad. But that means you're tripping once a day, okay, and potentially falling once a day. So I don't really like those odds, frankly. We want to find a way that we can prevent the trip from happening in the first place. And so by figuring out what's causing the trip, we hope to develop an algorithm or a prediction that will watch the person. So think about a little wearable device that you can wear around your ankle or on your foot that's tracking you at all times. And it's saying, no trip, no trip, no trip, no trip. And then all of a sudden it says trip and something activates, because something's gonna have to activate, because otherwise you're gonna trip. It's predicted that a trip is about to happen. And if we can predict that trip, we can intervene.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the devices we have in our cars now, that all of a sudden you get a little vibration and you see something on your dashboard. But somehow the sensation of the vehicle is detecting an aberrant pattern that it says this is a risk factor for, in this case, an accident. Mm-hmm. So I think it sounds like you're trying to develop the same sort of thing in real time,
yep,
which is really quite cool, because perhaps you can predict it pretty reliably before the person actually has that they had these micro falls that you're detecting.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to, in real time, monitor people's leg motions. We're monitoring for a potential trip. And if we can predict that trip is about to happen, maybe we're going to use electrical stimulation. Maybe we're going to use some sort of a robotic system that's strapped around your ankle that will lift your foot up a little bit higher, and that will keep you from tripping. And so we're trying to not just keep you from falling, we're trying to prevent the trip from happening in the first place.
What about people who take sleeping medicines? Mm-hmm. I have some real interest, given the number of people who have insomnia,
yeah,
which is, you know, tens and tens of millions across the United States, and probably every listener is going, that's me. And the idea that they take medications that do help them go to sleep, but it makes them groggy when they wake up in the middle of the night and have to go to the bathroom, and makes them maybe groggy when they first get up in the morning.
Yeah.
What do we do about those types of falls that aren't the type that we're usually just kind of walking in the daytime?
Yeah, those are definitely different falls. And we do hear about a lot of people falling at night or when they first get up in the morning because of that grogginess. And that's a real challenge, trying to figure out how to intervene in an appropriate way. And if we could prevent the grogginess from happening in the first place, that's ultimately where we would like to go.
Is there any advantage to people doing two things? Things like yoga and Pilates that work on both balance as well as strength. So I'm thinking about, you know, when you get out of bed, if you just kind of get moving real quickly, you might get dizzy from having just gotten out of bed versus actually just standing for a few seconds to get your balance and kind of get your orientation. Oh, I'm standing now.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's any real advantage to kind of that balance training and postural, we call, you know, being upright.
Yeah. Yeah, those are all good strategies. Certainly there's a lot of good evidence for some of the balance training programs that are out there, not just for older adults, but for a variety of different populations, depending on, you know, who you are. And the just kind of settling yourself is really important. I think a lot of falls happen because people rush and they think, I need to do this quickly. That's why a lot of falls happen at night. People get up and they rush to the bathroom and they're trying to get there really quickly, and that's when we tend to see a lot of falls.
So if we were to kind of fast forward and put ourselves in the examination room with patient, may have had a stroke, may not have had a stroke, mm-hmm, preferably beforehand, so we like to prevent those as well. What's the conversation about falls prevention? We're aging as a population. This is becoming more important, which is the rising science, mm-hmm, of this issue. What's the conversation like 5 and 10 years from now?
Yeah, I think you mentioned medication before, and I think medications play a big role in this, making sure that we're not overprescribing, making sure that the medications that people are taking are not causing some of the deficits that we know are going to lead to falls. So those are some of the issues. Again, as a physical therapist, we ask about medications. We don't prescribe medications, but we ask about them because we know that they're important. Thinking about things like nighttime issues, people, again, who have to get up and go to the bathroom a lot in the middle of the night. People who have pain tend to fall a lot more. People who have weakness, you know, you mentioned balance and balance training, and those are super critical. Making sure that we are assessing balance, you know, because that's something that as physical therapists we do a lot. We measure people's balance, we measure their strength, we measure their range of motion, and when we see issues, we try to intervene because we think that that's going to help reduce the number of falls.
Well, I really want to thank you, Dr. Mike Lewick, for coming in today And really, I think practically saying from the laboratory to the living person here in front of us and our patients and our family, what we can do differently to help prevent falls. And once they've occurred, how to prevent the next one.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Mike Lewick, Associate Professor of Physical Therapy in the UNC's Department of Allied Health Sciences, about the science of falls. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your own health questions or concerns. If any listener would like us to address any concerns on an upcoming show or questions, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura.
I've been having a little vision trouble for the first time in my life, and my eye doctor recently told me that it was from a cataract. He recommended surgery. I'm just confused. Is this not something we can correct with a new prescription? And if not, what should I expect?
Well, that's a interesting and important question, in part because I'll probably be in that same place myself in the next 10 years. Like, cataracts are maybe the most common surgery that's done in the country and probably one of the most common in the world. And what a cataract is this cloudiness of the part of the eye called the lens, and that cloudiness, it's almost like scar tissue. And when it gets cloudy like that, it really does cause blurred vision. And left untreated, actually, it can cause you to go blind.
Oh, wow.
Right. Most people think, oh, it's just I can't see
as well. It just seems so common.
And it does seem to happen for people who get older, which we all will get there. But also it's linked to smoking, alcohol abuse, being out in the sun a lot more, and things like diabetes. So there's things that are related to what we might call inflammation in the body that also can cause it. So things we can do something about, right? You could choose not to be in the sun, quit drinking, and quit smoking. So anyone who has decline in vision without pain and they're over the age of 60 should be suspect, and they really do need to have an evaluation. And a cataract surgery is very low risk. And you do need to make sure your blood pressure is controlled and make the changes in your lifestyle so that if you have the surgery, you're not going to have these happen again. But I think that's the main thing that's done, because the surgery is safe, easy. People can go home really quite quickly, and they see better quickly.
Yeah, that's always a plus.
That's a really, really good thing. There's lots of different kind of ways that the surgeons do it, and you may or may not know the surgeon, and you can ask friends who they're doing it with. Okay. Most times people have limited networks that they have to do, but usually if the surgeon says this is what's causing it, that's probably correct. And usually if you have it in one eye, you may well have it in the other eye. It's not usually done at the same time because you don't want to risk maybe infection. And so you would do one, and then at some point in time in the near future, you might do the other after you get better. What's our very next house call?
I was recently in the hospital with a compression fracture of my spine. I have osteoporosis, and my doctor said one of the reasons might be my smoking. A young doctor came by and spent about 30 minutes talking with me about how to quit and how this might help prevent future fractures. This was the first time I've had a doctor seriously have such a conversation about my smoking in 40 years. What do you think has changed?
Someone made a connection.
Yeah, bravo, young doctor.
Yeah, they made a connection between your disease, osteoporosis, compression fracture. We were just talking about cataracts and smoking, but and the fact that perhaps one of your major risk factors that can be changed, preventable risk factor, is the smoking and the thinning of the bones there. So I think what's changing is that increasingly people realize that when people come into the hospital, whether it's with a tobacco-related disease, alcohol-related disease, that these are opportunities to intervene. And if you don't do what's causing it, you're just, in some respects, doing a Band-Aid. We could put you on the pain medicine, treat the fracture. It may heal up, but then you're going to get another one.
Right.
And so you really have to go to the next step. What's causing it and what can we do to prevent it? So I think this hospital system, we have a program such as this at the University of North Carolina. Other hospitals in the country do. Not enough do, frankly, because it is a evidence-based, successful intervention. It can get people to quit. It can prevent many of the diseases that people would subsequently come back to the hospital with.
Right.
It's a win-win.
Yeah, it really is.
No real downside.
No, it doesn't seem like it at all.
But what people need to know is the help they may need to quit. That's what that doctor is offering, too. It's not just the advice. It's probably offering help, whether it's calling a quit line in every 50 states in the country or offering intensive counseling and or medications. Well, thank you for that question. We hope that you get better with your compression fracture as well as your smoking. What's our very last house call?
I'm in my 70s and I'm being treated for cancer with one of these new powerful directed cancer drugs. While I'm sure it's helping my cancer, I've also noticed that I have really loose stools multiple times a day, and that's pretty debilitating. Do you think this is due to the drug or do you think it could be something else?
You know, this reminds me, one of my mentors told me something that I've used many times in medicine, which is that common things happen commonly, uncommon things happen uncommonly, but uncommon things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that describes almost all of medicine.
And the world.
And the world. But the question is, which of those things is operative? Which of those things is linked to this particular case?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you have a patient who was not having loose stools. They had cancer, still perhaps weren't having diarrhea or loose stools. They started a very potent drug, an anti-cancer drug, potent.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started developing diarrhea. So are those things more likely to be related? Common things happen commonly. You started a new drug that's powerful. You got a side effect. Or is it an uncommon reaction? I mean, diarrhea after taking a medicine, pretty common.
Right.
You've heard of that. Antibiotics, a lot of other drugs, you know, can cause that. So that's a common thing. So it's not an uncommon thing.
Right.
So common things happen commonly.
Yeah.
And then uncommon things happen uncommonly. So something else like a new cancer causing this or like, well, maybe if you take an antibiotics, you can have these antibiotic type reactions. Okay, but you didn't take antibiotics. At least we didn't hear that. So to then look for uncommon things is not going to be there. Now, it could happen. So you still have to think about it. But most likely, this is from that common thing happen commonly.
Right. Well, it sounds like something maybe the doctor can help you, you know, think through and look at and...
Yeah, and I can tell you, these potent drugs, they're really good, but diarrhea is probably one of the most common side effects of these drugs. Mm-hmm. It can happen 30 to 50% of the time.
That's a lot.
It's not a rare side effect. Now, the question is, will it go away? Can you take things like, you know, Imodium or one of these things that can help bind it? Can you do anything with your diet and change it around to let you tolerate the medicine but maybe not have the diarrhea? That's the question.
The goal, yeah.
Yeah. So I talk with your cancer doctor, your primary care doctor, see what they think. But thanks for the question. Great questions. We want to really thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can share any question by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Michael Lewick. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.